This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalrymple Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
I'm going to tackle two questions this month. The first is from Matt, who asks, is there a lower limit to the frequencies of electromagnetic radiation that are usable or detectable with current equipment? Is there a lower limit to how low a frequency can exist? Well, in short, no. There isn't a theoretical limit to how low you can go, but there are limits in practice. So let's think about what we're talking about first. Electromagnetic radiation is what I'd call light, and it's often described as a wave. You can visualize it like a water wave, rippling up and down. The wave has a frequency, which is how often it completes one ripple. So if you wiggle your hand in water, you get a wave with a high frequency if you wiggle fast, and a wave with a low frequency if you wiggle slowly. A light wave can have any frequency, and all the different frequencies you can have make up what's called the electromagnetic spectrum. At one end of the spectrum are very high frequencies, and we call these gamma rays and X-rays. As the frequency gets lower, we get to ultraviolet, and then visible light, which is what we see with our eyes. So then the visible part of the spectrum is a rainbow, going from violet at the high frequency end to red at the low frequency end. So that means what we see as colours are actually the different frequencies of visible light. Then if you carry on reducing the frequency, you get to infrared, then what astronomers call submillimeter, then microwaves, and finally radio waves. All of that is the same stuff, from the X-rays used in hospitals, the light you see around you, to the radio waves that carry signals to your television aerial. It's all electromagnetic radiation, and the only difference is the frequency. It's called electromagnetic radiation because it's made of an electric field and a magnetic field, and that's what light is. So that's the same sort of electric field that makes electricity flow in a wire, and it's the same sort of magnetic field that makes a magnet stick to your fridge door. A field, in this case, just means a space in which some force is exerted on certain things. So an electric field in a wire makes the little particles called electrons move, and that's electricity. A fridge magnet creates a magnetic field around itself, which pulls it towards metal, such as you have in your fridge door. You get a wave when you have electric and magnetic fields that change in strength. So the wave isn't going up and down like water. What's waving is the strength of the electric and magnetic fields. They rise and pull harder, then they drop and pull less hard, and then repeat. This makes two amazing things happen. Firstly, the two fields power each other. So as the electric field changes, it produces a changing magnetic field. And as the magnetic field changes, it produces a changing electric field. And so they actually drive each other. Secondly, the energy within the two fields moves along through space in a straight line. And that energy, of course, moves at the speed of light, because these two fields together are light. The changing electric and magnetic fields are an electromagnetic wave. So, to bring it back to the question, that wave changes with a certain frequency, as we've said. And the question was, can you keep making the frequency lower and lower? Well, if we take the limit of that, you could have electric and magnetic fields together that don't change at all over time. And that would sort of be electromagnetic radiation with a frequency of zero. Except then it wouldn't go anywhere. It wouldn't actually travel like radiation does. So really it would stop being a wave. And it's like completely still water. You could say it has waves of zero frequency in it, but that's really the same as saying there are no waves at all. But you can get as close to zero as you like without actually hitting it. We stop giving names to it once we get down to radio waves, but that's only for our convenience. The fields can change ever more slowly, even if it means they take the whole age of the universe to oscillate once. In radio astronomy, we're accustomed to detecting frequencies of about 1 gigahertz, which means a billion oscillations per second, and that's quite low for light, even if it doesn't sound it. But telescopes like LOFAR, the low frequency array, go down to about 10 megahertz, or 10 million oscillations per second. This lets us see things in space that we might be unable to detect at other frequencies. In particular, radiation from very distant objects is reduced in frequency as it travels through our universe because the universe is expanding, and that redshifts or reduces the frequency of radiation that comes from the far reaches of the cosmos, and LOFAR can pick this up. So why not go lower and see even more? Detectors could go very low. As long as you can measure the electrical magnetic field changing, you can pick up the wave. The problem for astronomers is that very low frequencies don't actually reach us, and the main barrier is our atmosphere. There's a layer to our atmosphere called the ionosphere, which stops very low frequencies of radiation from getting through. The material in the ionosphere is hot enough to be ionized plasma, which means the atoms it is made of don't have their electrons bound to their nuclei, which is the way it is for colder things. Instead, the electrons are free to move all over the place. They interact with electromagnetic radiation that's coming in from space, for example, and they will then actually oscillate at a certain frequency called the plasma frequency. So if the radiation is below the plasma frequency, the plasma oscillations in the ionosphere absorb or reflect its energy, so it doesn't pass through. Now, this varies depending on the weather and other factors like the sun's activity, but our ionosphere stops radiation below about 10 megahertz from getting through to the ground, which is why LOFAR stops observing around there. Now, if you're out in space, you might think you'd be okay because you're outside the atmosphere, and your situation is improved somewhat, but there's still ionized plasma in space. Part of the interstellar medium, which is the stuff between the stars, is plasma. The plasma frequency goes down with the density of electrons in your plasma, and the interstellar medium is really sparse, so it lets through lower frequencies than our atmosphere, all the way down to about 10 kilohertz, which is 10,000 oscillations per second. But below that, the radiation will all have been absorbed by the interstellar medium before it gets to us. Which is a shame, because there are electromagnetic waves at lower frequencies than that generated by things which have electric and magnetic fields and spin in space, like pulsars. They produce radiation at frequencies below 1 kilohertz, because they rotate at less than 1,000 times a second, but we don't get to see that radiation directly. Sometimes it's absorbed by a nebula around the pulsar, as in the case of the Crab Nebula, and then we get to see the nebula glowing as it re-emits the energy at higher frequencies, but we can't see the original radiation directly. So in conclusion, if you have a space with no free electrons in it at all, then electromagnetic waves can propagate at as low a frequency as you like, except actually zero. Detectors can certainly go down to very low frequencies. But the interstellar medium in our own galaxy limits astronomers to about 10 kilohertz, while the Earth's atmosphere limits us more strictly to around 10 megahertz. And so, in light of this difference, I'd definitely be in favour of having a big array of very low frequency radio telescopes on the moon, where there's no atmosphere. I think that would be brilliant. The second question is from Peter Baxter, who has a query about quantum entanglement and black holes. And he says, if you entangled a pair of particles near a black hole, and one of the particles fell into the black hole and the other one didn't, would you be able to observe the properties of the particle that escaped? Wouldn't the properties of both particles, such as their spin, be destroyed when one particle was crushed by the black hole? Wow, that is a deep question. And I'm not going to pretend that I know everything about entanglement. In fact, I'm not sure anyone does. But first, let's look at what entanglement is. It's part of quantum theory, which is the physics of very small things. If two particles are entangled, it means that their measurable properties are related to each other. So Peter used the example of spin as a property. Fundamental particles like electrons have spin, and it's a form of angular momentum. Angular momentum is a property found in the microscopic world and all the way up to the macroscopic world. So particles spin, tennis balls spin, and whole planets spin. So now let's suppose that the two particles in the question are entangled. Maybe they were formed together in a reaction of some kind, and that's why. They might, for example, have to have opposite values of spin. So like one of them spinning clockwise, one of them spinning anti-clockwise. That would be a form of entanglement. The weird thing about quantum theory is, before you measure this spin, you assume that each particle has a bit of both senses of spin. particle A could be, for example, half a clockwise spinning particle and half an anti-clockwise spinning particle. And then particle B would be in a similar state. Now, if you're confused about how something can be in more than one state at once, then that's good, because you're confronting the weirdness of quantum theory. When you measure the spin of particle A, you will find it's either clockwise or anti-clockwise, not both. Some people interpret this as meaning that the particle changes from a bit of both to a single state due to the measurement you make, because a measurement always involves some interaction with the particle, so it could change it. There are other interpretations, but I will just baffle myself if I go into them. The fact is that, however you look at it, once you measure the spin of particle A, you know the spin of particle B must go the opposite way, because the particles were entangled with one another. So, what if you measure particle A, but particle B has fallen into a black hole? A black hole is another strange concept. It's not an empty hole, but rather a very dense thing. It has mass concentrated into a tiny volume. A black hole can be formed by the collapse of a star at the end of its life, for example. And then close to the black hole, its gravity is so strong that nothing can escape, not even light. And this means that astronomers, frustratingly, can't get information directly from inside a black hole. At least, we don't think we can, but you'd have to ask Stephen Hawking about whether it might be possible. He and other theoretical physicists think about what the nature of black holes might be and how they might fit into quantum theory. And there are lots of open questions. One of those is, what happens to the properties of things when they fall into a black hole? And this is really what Peter is asking. Do those properties just get destroyed? And what does that mean for entangled particles whose properties are related to each other? Well, there's still debate. No current observational evidence can settle it, and I certainly can't. All known black holes are much too far away for us to throw a particle into, so we can't test it very easily. However, Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity, does show that black holes themselves do have some properties, and this isn't really disputed. One of the properties of a black hole is mass, as we've already said. One is electrical charge, and one is angular momentum. So when particle B falls into a black hole, we don't know what happens to all its physical properties. But its mass becomes part of the black hole, so the black hole gets bigger and heavier. Its charge becomes part of the black hole, if it has charge. So a black hole can be positively or negatively charged. And its spin becomes part of the black hole as well, so black holes can rotate. And that's angular momentum. So as weird as black holes and quantum theory undoubtedly are, it seems that they do allow the universe to conserve energy, charge, and angular momentum. Conservation means that those quantities don't increase or decrease in the universe overall, they just get moved around. So we should be able to measure the spin of particle A, which has escaped the black hole, and when we do, we'll be able to say that its entangled partner, particle B, must have given the opposite amount of spin to the black hole when it fell in. And as for other properties of the particles, speculate away. So thank you to Matt and Peter for the questions. We really like to try and answer your questions, however deep they may be. And so if you want to get in touch, please do so via the usual channels.